It's true. Across the globe, women aren't as prosperous as men. Gender inequality is a pressing moral issue, but we forget it has massive economic implications. If you were to put all of the women who don't have access to formal financial services in one place, they would make up the third largest country in the world. That means an entire population without bank accounts, credit cards, or other tools you and I likely benefit from daily. Prosperity for women starts with inclusive policies, products, and people around the globe, and the investment to make it happen. Welcome to the Making Finance Work for Women podcast. My name is Sonia Kelly, and I lead Women's World Banking's proprietary research division. Join me as I speak with changemakers around the globe to deconstruct the social and economic exclusion women face. We'll discover new evidence together and drive action to accelerate women's economic empowerment. Because a leg up isn't a handout, it's a global game changer. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. On this episode, we're going to be exploring the highly relevant and sometimes controversial topic of ethics for applications of artificial intelligence and machine learning in the financial sector. Please don't turn off this podcast because that sounded a little too technical for you. It's actually quite relevant to your life and mine and to the lives of low-income women around the world. Before I introduce our guest, let me give you an example. We know that women are less likely to have a formal credit score because they have lower access to technology and are much more likely to operate in the informal rather than formal financial system than men are. But the rise of data and new credit assessment technologies allows for new ways of getting credit to women and closing that stubborn $1.7 trillion gender credit gap in the world. Take a low-income e-commerce entrepreneur in Indonesia, for example. Let's call her Dwi. Maybe Dwi makes food during her toddler's nap time and after he goes to bed, and then she posts it online and sells it on Gojek, which is a popular food delivery service. Dwi might have a digital footprint, a list of customers, an inventory, and a track record of her earnings, even though she's never had a credit card. In a highly data-driven world, she could tell a financial institution to look her up on Gojek and Facebook for Business and determine her creditworthiness. And so this brings us to the potential of AI and machine learning to give her a credit score, but also to the challenge of ensuring that these new scoring models and other applications of AI and machine learning don't introduce new lines of exclusion in the formal financial system. If you have any thoughts or ideas, please share them in the chat on LinkedIn and I'll answer right back right now. We're also sharing some resources in the chat for you to follow up with if you want to. And if you're multitasking and listening on audio only, you won't miss any of our conversation, I promise, but you can also check the back and forth and resources later on LinkedIn. So let's turn to our guest, who's an expert on the topic of ethical AI and machine learning, Dr. Reid Blackman. Reid is the author of Ethical Machines, Your Concise Guide to Totally Unbiased, Transparent, and Respectful AI, published by Harvard Business Review Press. He's also the founder and CEO of Virtue, an AI ethical risk consultancy, and volunteer chief ethics officer for the nonprofit Government Blockchain Association. He's also been a member of EY's AI Advisory Board, a senior advisor to the Deloitte AI Institute, and a professor of philosophy at Colgate University and UNC Chapel Hill. His work, which includes advising and speaking to organizations including AWS, US Bank, the FBI, NASA, the World Economic Forum, and now us, has been profiled in the Wall Street Journal and Forbes. You can learn more about him at reidblackman.com, but you'll also learn about him today. So hi, Reid. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Thanks for joining us. I loved your book, which I'm holding up here. It was a real page turner for me, and my family has seen me carrying it around even on vacation. So
I'm afraid that most people will think you're being sarcastic when you say a book on AI ethics was a real page turner.
I'm not kidding. It was a page turner and quite relevant to our work here at Women's World Banking. So I've been looking forward to this conversation for a long time. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Let me get started. Before we dive into the book and some of that, I'm really curious. You founded an AI ethical risk consultancy, which like wasn't even a type of company 20 years ago. Yeah. So I'm curious, what's been your journey in this topic and this focus in your work?
That's a fair question. It's not a thing. And AI ethics consultancies certainly weren't a thing when I started one about 4 or 5 years ago. Prior to doing this, I was a philosophy professor, always specializing in ethics. So I have a PhD in philosophy, and I've been researching, teaching, publishing on ethics for 20 plus years. As a philosophy professor, I was also an advisor to startups. That has to do with some other business that I had, a fireworks wholesaling business, which is its own story. But I was watching all these students do these really cool, new, interesting things. And I thought, oh, I want to do something cool, new, and interesting. What would that be? Well, I don't want to leave ethics. It's still something that I care a lot about, that I find really fascinating, and I want to spend all my intellectual and mental energies on. What would that look like? I guess it would be an ethics consultancy. But what's an ethics consultancy? Does that exist? Is there such a thing? And the short answer was no. You know, the other question was, is there a market for that? Am I going to be able to sell anything? And at the time, I think the answer was no. And then at some point, but this was around the time of Me Too, Black Lives Matter, Cambridge Analytica, that's when I realized, okay, yeah, there's a market now for this. And somehow or other, I heard the engineers ringing alarm bells around AI ethics, about the ethical impacts of AI. And I thought, okay, between Me Too and BLM and AI and the way in which AI scales, especially the scales discrimination, companies are going to have to get their ethical houses in order. But they don't really know much about ethics standardly. But I do. That's my specialty. And so, you know, that plus a number of other factors, I left academia and I started the business.
Great. I love that you kind of created your own path there. I'm curious, you know, you talk about the market for this and you sort of created a market and listened to what demand might be and is going to be as we move into a world that has more AI and machine learning, both in the foreground and the background. Why should an executive who's listening to this podcast care about ensuring that their machines are ethical?
So first, I wouldn't say that I created the market. That's giving me too much credit. I may have played some role in making it the case that there's a market because I played some role in making people aware of the ethical and reputational risks. But it's really because, I don't know how many thousands or tens of thousands of people were recognizing that there's a problem and started, you know, posting on social media, journalists started paying attention, more junior data scientists and engineers started talking to their bosses. There are various kinds of nonprofits geared towards what a lot of people call tech for good. So I sort of got lucky in a way. I mean, I placed a bet that this would become a pressing issue for companies, and the bet worked out, but it would be too self-congratulatory for me to say I made that market. I made a good bet, it seems. Okay, why should those executives care? I sort of alluded to it a little bit. Ethical risks are also reputational risks, and they're also regulatory and legal risks. So, you know, when you do something bad with AI, when things go ethically sideways with AI, you do it at scale. Because AI is the kind of thing that it's supposed to operate at scale. It's supposed to affect thousands, tens of thousands, millions of people. That's the whole point. That's one of the appeals of AI. So that means that when things go ethically sideways, you do it at scale, which journalists pick up on, which people posting on social media pick up on. And so there's real reputational risks when things go ethically sideways. There's also regulatory risks and legal risks. So for instance, literally just today, the General Attorney of California notified all the CEOs of all the hospitals in California that they're asking for information about all of their algorithms. They didn't use the word AI, but that's what was implied. Algorithmic decisions related to risk ratings for patients and diagnoses of patients. So they're quite serious about it. I mean, California's quite serious about it. And now these hospitals need to figure out, how do we answer the General Attorney of California?
Yeah, I hear there were two things you just mentioned I wanted to pick up on. As I've talked to financial services providers, I've heard a couple things. One is, like, they want to be able to say that their AI and machine learning or algorithms are ethical. And so it's almost like defensive, like, oh, of course we're ethical, which I think is really interesting and probably a reaction to what they're seeing in other industries. Like they're hearing about that Amazon HR AI from a couple of years ago, or, you know, about discrimination with within, I don't know, facial recognition technology. They're hearing about that and they're saying, oh, we also have an algorithm. Like, of course it's ethical. But I also see them kind of anticipating this threat of regulation in the financial sector. And we talked about this in a report we released a couple of years ago called Algorithmic Bias, Financial Inclusion, and Gender. And, you know, they were saying privately, like, this is, it's coming. We know regulation on this is coming if it's not here in our market already. And I think we're seeing that in the U.S. too.
Yeah, regulations are coming. Most notably, they're coming out of the EU. So there's the EU AI Act, which people think will go into effect probably late 2024. Maybe it'll go into 2025. But yeah, those regulations are just about AI ethics, or at least they certainly include AI ethics. So they're talking about discriminatory algorithms and black boxes and privacy violations. And financial services, they've, to my great surprise, outside of the big tech firms, they've been the most proactive about trying to address these things because they already know regulators are crawling all over them. Regulators are looking. And they already have a decent grip on, not more than decent, they have a good grip on model risk management. Not machine learning model risk management, but model risk management. So they actually have internal resources that they can use to do AI ethical risk mitigation. And they've got the culture of we need to have good answers to regulators if and when they come knocking.
That's good. It's good to hear that as your professional assessment of the financial system and their approach compared to other sectors.
My prediction, by the way, was that healthcare was going to lead the way. Outside of big tech, I thought healthcare would lead the way because healthcare already speaks the language of ethics. You've got the Belmont, for those of you who know about the Belmont Report, you have the Belmont Report, which came after the Tuskegee experiments, and you have ethical standards, you have IRBs, institutional review boards that review all research done prior to testing on human subjects. And so I thought, well, you know, they understand ethics, so they're going to be big on AI ethics. And I was wrong. They're getting there now, but to my surprise, they're behind financial services, at least from my sort of, I guess, relatively anecdotal experience. But I'm paying pretty close attention.
You mentioned that financial institutions have kind of a risk model in place already. I think that's a fair point. But let's kind of think about a scenario in which you would work with a client and talk about what you might do for a client that might not have a risk model in place within their institution. So I mentioned in my example at the beginning, you know, a woman who might have a tech footprint, but not a credit footprint. And the institutions that would be serving her would most likely be the ones that are experimenting. And so maybe a small fintech. Let's say it's a small fintech that has under 50 employees and they hired a lawyer to write their terms and conditions, but didn't keep them on staff. And they're using some off-the-shelf AI and adapting it. You know, they don't have a lot of capacity. Can you talk me through like how you would work with an institution like that compared to, you know, US Bank, who's one of your clients? Like how do you work with the little guys who might not have the bandwidth to care about this or to do something on it, even if they do care about it?
Yeah. So if they don't care, I can't do anything. you know, I'm not a hard pitch kind of person, so I'm not going to say, look, here's why you must do it. You're not going to move those people. And those smaller organizations are hard because even when they do care, to your point, they have limited resources. There's a number of things to do. I mean, there's various kinds of free resources available online. There are technical bias detectors. So there's things that are available for free that they can use. And then I think, you know, there are also algorithmic auditing companies. Some of them just do the straight up auditing. Some of them do advisory work. I'm on the advisory side. I don't typically do algorithmic auditing. But that's, you know, you got to spend a little, usually if you want an external expert to come in and help you with the stuff, it's going to cost a little bit of money. But look, there's a big difference between a multinational corporation who has resources and who does need really robust risk mitigation for a variety of reasons, and the smaller organizations who need to, you know, they need to mitigate their risks, but they don't have, frankly, they don't have the same kind of bottom line risks that the big ones do. They don't have a reputation that's going to get dragged through the mud. The regulators are unlikely to come after them when they're super small. So there's a little bit less bottom line reason, and it's more, we really just don't want to ethically mess things up. We don't want to discriminate. Anyway, I don't know if that answered your question. The short answer is that, yeah, it's tough. I mean, look, you're trying to accomplish something. You've got a goal. The goal is to not discriminate against women, say, in how you lend credit, or if not women, poor women or poor people generally, et cetera. And it's going to take resources. It's going to take time, just like everything does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we actually just published a tool that we're calling Check Your Bias, which is a list of 6 different indicators that a financial institution can use to as sort of a benchmark for themselves. And then, you know, maybe a CEO could hand it to their data scientist and say, I want a quarterly report that I can send to the board on the percent of women versus the percent of men who applied and what percent of them got credit, what percent of them were rejected, what the score would be for those who are rejected, like some interesting questions. And so I see your point that, you know, the risks for a smaller institution might be lower because they don't have that scale play. But there are things that they can do, even if they don't have the like capacity to hire a chief ethics officer or something.
Yeah, no, and they don't need to do anything so grand as that. I don't even think multinationals necessarily have to hire something like a chief AI ethics officer. It might not be a bad idea, but I don't think it's required of all organizations or something like that. Look, there's a difference between being able to identify that some output, some outcome of how you're using your AI is discriminatory. There's that on the one hand. And I think that is relatively easy for a smaller organization to do because there are metrics for these kinds of things. You can take a look at the rates at which you lend to these people versus those people versus these other people. So, of course, the tricky part, and this is where it gets more complicated and takes more time and resources, is, well, what does bias mitigation look like? How do we do it? And the answer is not always the same. There are loads of ways that you can get biased or discriminatory outputs from your AI, which means there are loads of different strategies that you can employ to mitigate those biases. And now we're going to start to get a little bit technical when we're talking about things like, what does your training data look like? Where did you set your thresholds? How did you weight the input variables? And a bunch of other, you know, more technical things. And so you're going to have to dive in a little more detail. The other thing is that there's questions about what stage of the AI product lifecycle do you start looking for these things? If you're a multinational, you need to be looking at every stage of the product lifecycle, from concept development to design to, you know, building to putting it into production to monitoring everything from the second you think maybe we should use AI to retiring, okay, we're done with this AI solution, right? You got to have regular checks. A smaller organization might not have the resources to do those kinds of regular checks, but maybe they can do it before they start, you know, before they even start coding or training or collecting training data. Maybe they do it, you know, halfway through the project, and then they do it right before they release or something along those lines, right? So I do think, to your point, that scorecard sounds like a great start at identifying the problem. It's the systematic solutions for the problems where things get more complicated and potentially expensive. But of course, you know, you tailor these things to what the organization can handle.
Okay, we're getting into a part of your book I really liked, which was, I don't know, when I picked up your book and it was called Ethical Machines, I thought it was going to be like another version of these like principles for AI that we see coming out of big tech. Yeah. And it wasn't at all. You talked a lot more about process, and you separate this into content and structure. You talk about it as not like a check the box thing, but more of a dynamic conversation within an institution, which from an intellectual perspective, I really liked because it was much more nuanced, but it also seemed much more practical at actually affecting change within an organization. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what that creates in an institution from a culture perspective. And I imagine you might have some examples of AI not being left up to you being hired or to like some person that's the AI ethics czar in an institution, but rather the goal of everybody. And you mentioned at the beginning, like maybe a data scientist or a coder flags this for a leader in an organization. So I wonder about a healthy organization and what that looks like if they care about AI ethics.
Yeah, great. So what does it look like? It could look lots of different ways depending on what the organization is, how large it is, what resources they have, how much, if you like, AI they're doing internally, how much they're procuring AI. And that's just something worth flagging, that there's lots of organizations that don't have internal data scientists or AI engineers working on machine learning models, but their head of HR may very well have an email in their inbox right now from an AI vendor selling them a solution, quote unquote solution, for some HR issue. Yes, look, I think if we're talking about an organization that does have those people working internally, those data scientists and AI engineers, et cetera, then they need to have some level of education about these issues, about what the risks are. And they need some way of doing some kind of risk assessment. And they need to do that risk assessment throughout the product lifecycle. So when they're thinking about what the solution might be, when they start collecting training data, when they start training their model, you know, and those might be different people, by the way, right? So might be these people who collect the data and those other people who train the model, likely is, especially in a large organization, in which case you need to make sure that there's open lines of communication between the data collectors and those training the model and those testing and validating the model, those monitoring the model, et cetera. So you're going to have some good education for those people, especially because it's totally new to them. I mean, I'm not blaming them. They could be very good people, but they might not know much about the ethical risks of AI. If they do, they might not really understand the sources very well, the sources of those risks, and they may not understand what appropriate risk mitigation strategies and tactics look like. And so they need education. But it would be very unwise and unfair for an organization to just rely on their data scientists to fix the problem. And the short of it is, and this is, you know, I come back to this point in the book again and again, is that you can't math your way out of these problems. You are going to have to make substantive, ethical, qualitative decisions that can be informed by the numbers, but those decisions are not, if you like, determined by the numbers. Still, good judgment needs to rule over all of it. So what's really important is for data scientists, product teams, et cetera, to be able to smell ethical smoke, to teach them how to smell ethical smoke, and then to give them a lever to pull when they smell it. And then it's got to go to someone. And then where that goes, it's going to vary by organization. So for some organizations, it's going to go to a particular subject matter expert who's going to weigh in, who's going to help them, and then it stops there. In some organizations, they call these people AI ethics champions. So Microsoft has a model like this. Telefonica has a model like this. In other cases, it doesn't go to an individual, it goes to a general board. Microsoft has an Office of Responsible AI, so and in there are people, including people with PhDs in philosophy, I might add, who will help those product teams think through the ethical risks of their AI product. It could be a combination. It goes to the champion, and then if the champion says, oh, look, this needs even a deeper look, then it goes up to the board, right? And so on and so forth. So there's lots of different ways. The main thing here is that, you know, sort of if you like the big picture takeaway, is that what organizations need to do is acquire an organizational capacity to responsibly deal with these issues. That's the big thing that they need to do. So it's not a check mark, right? It's not, yes, our data scientists looked for this, they didn't find anything, check. No, it's a capacity to systematically and comprehensively identify and mitigate the ethical risks of AI.
Yeah, that's really nuanced. That's why I really liked your book.
Yeah, thanks.
I'd love to ask a couple, maybe more editorial questions, and I'm burying this in the last third of our interview, or not burying it, but I'm putting it here because I think this is the stuff that people think about but don't really want to ask. The first question is, you know, you mentioned at the beginning this sort of tech for good I don't know, momentum that we've seen in the tech space. But you talk about in your book, you talk about AI for not bad. I thought that was really interesting. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so it depends about how technically you want to get. I mean, look, so look, I was a philosopher. And so I still am. I'm not really sure. It depends on what you mean by a philosopher. I'm not a philosophy professor anymore.
You're totally a philosopher still.
Yeah. Okay, fine. I guess the very fact that I'm sort of thinking about, wait, so am I, do I qualify as one, is sufficient evidence that I am. There's a difference between good and bad. If I wanted to put it really technically, I would say that good and bad are related as contraries, not contradictories. Which is to say something can be, it can be good. If it's not good, it doesn't mean it's bad. It might be neutral. When people say, look, we're for the good stuff, okay, but what does that mean? You're only going to do good? Are you only going to do good? Because there's not usually a viable business model behind that, right? So if you're a bank, you want to do what banks do. You want to give mortgages or lend people money generally. You're going to want to hire people, and you might use AI to hire people. You might use AI for marketing purposes. You might use AI for all sorts of things. And the important thing there is not that you do a bunch of good in the world. The important thing there is that in pursuing your business objectives, you don't inadvertently create a bunch of bad stuff. For instance, you don't inadvertently discriminate against women or Black women in particular or Southeast Asian women in particular or whatever at scale. That you don't use black boxes. That is to say, your AI operates in some way that you can't possibly explain. You don't do that in high-risk cases, for instance, or that you don't massively violate people's privacy as you're using AI to pursue your business objectives. So people talk a lot about, yeah, tech for good. You want to have positive social impact. I think that's a great thing. Go for it. But I don't think that should be the focus for businesses. I think the focus for businesses should be, look, we're going to do what we're going to do. Let's just do it in a way that's not ethically problematic. And that should be the focus. So that's what I call AI ethics for not bad, or AI for not bad. Just trying to not make things worse or not violate people's rights or default on obligations, et cetera.
Yeah, I think that's a much better standard for the industry, to not slap a tech for good label on something because it's not discriminatory, but rather just to say, like, the goal is not tech for good, but rather to meet business objectives while not hurting people.
Right.
I think that's very practical. My second maybe controversial question is, ooh, under what circumstances would it be okay for an algorithm to discriminate, let's say, against women, because that's what we care about here? I'll give you maybe a scenario that we have talked about at Women's World Banking. We talked with digital credit institutions as part of that report that I mentioned on algorithmic bias, financial inclusion, and gender. And we said to them, like, what are your top variables that explain why somebody might or might not be given access to credit? And this was in the early days of the pandemic, but one of the top variables for many institutions that were collecting GPS data through phones, so these were like mobile applications, they were collecting GPS data through phones along with a host of other data, but they said GPS data was a good determinant of whether somebody who applied for a small business loan would be creditworthy. And their defense was, well, if people spend more time at their business location, like if they leave their house and go to a place for 8 hours a day, they might be more creditworthy than somebody who leaves their house and goes to a place for 2 hours a day and sits and sells stuff and then goes home. But we know that women have greater unpaid care responsibilities, especially in emerging markets. And so women's GPS data is highly correlated with how much time they spend at their business. I mean, things with the pandemic have really shifted with lockdowns and everything. So this is a safe example to use because I'm sure these companies have updated their algorithms, but we've talked about that internally. Is that a circumstance in which it's okay for an algorithm to discriminate against women using a highly gendered variable?
That's a great question. So, okay, there's a bunch of things to say. So first of all, if by discriminate you mean to wrong somebody, that discriminating against someone is a way of wronging them, then the question becomes, is there ever a case in which it's okay to wrong these people? And standardly, the answer is no. Standardly, if you've wronged someone, that's something that, all else equal, you ought not to be done. Are there cases and cases and cases? Yes. And, you know, could we find a case where, well, if you didn't wrong these people, you know, these three people, you'd have to wrong these 1,000 people. So better to wrong the three people than the 1,000 people. Sure, fine. But all else equal, it's wrong to wrong people, or something along those lines. You ought not to wrong people. It's ethically bad to wrong people. Okay, so that's the first thing to say. So let me put it slightly differently. It would only be okay to discriminate, which is to say wrong some people, say women, on the condition that failing to do so would find you in breach of an even more stringent obligation that you have. Right, so to really bump it up, let's say, you know, if we discriminate against these 100 people, we'll save the world. Otherwise, the world collapses. Okay, you know, then do it, right? Because you have a more stringent obligation to save the world from collapsing than you do to not discriminate against those people. So it's about stringency of obligations. But if there are no other obligations in the mix, this is me speaking as an ethicist, you know, as opposed to something like figuring out a business's ethical risk appetite versus their financial risk appetite. Things get a little bit more complicated there. But from an ethicist's perspective, you're only going to be justified in doing some wrong on the condition that there's some other worse wrong thing. So there's some other obligation that you have that's more pressing, more ethically pressing. So does that begin to answer the question?
Yeah, and I think that's why this has to be a conversation rather than a list of check the box rules that an institution has to follow, because it gets really complicated, and it's not as easy as saying, and I'm going to get sort of on, this is going to be a little bit too on the nose for the U.S. regulatory environment, and it's a good thing I'm not a financial institution, but it's not as easy as saying the location of where somebody lives is protected and can't be used, especially in a an environment with a huge amount of data that can be used to predict creditworthiness.
Yeah. You know, your question, I think, there's really two questions. Is it ever okay to discriminate against, say, women? That's one question. Another question that's related is it ever okay to use variables while training your AI that highly correlate with gender, race, ethnicity, et cetera, et cetera? And the short answer is probably yes, there are cases in which it's okay to use those variables that highly correlate with race, gender, ethnicity, et cetera. First of all, there are just cases or contexts in which you have to do it in order to do your job well. So this is not finance, but in healthcare, different ethnicities show symptoms differently. So present symptoms differently, or present symptoms of various diseases differently. And so you have to pay attention to those kinds of things if you're going to get accurate diagnoses. But the other thing is that, you know, there are going to be legitimate variables that just so happen to correlate with race and ethnicity. But, you know, they're legitimate. Whatever, you know, now, are they legitimate? Was using GPS data in that particular case legitimate? Well, one way we can ask that question is whether it's empirically legitimate. I mean, is there really that? Is there sufficient evidence for thinking that someone's geolocation or how much time they spend at a business address versus a home address, does it, A, correlate with people repaying their loans? If it does correlate, can we establish any kind of causal relation between those two things? So one of the ways in which it might fail to be legitimate is just that it might be bad science. It's just bad science. It may be good science, and now that changes things a little bit. Now we have not... Is it empirically legitimate, if you like, or scientifically legitimate to use those variables? But is it ethically permissible to use those variables? And it's not obvious, at any rate, that the answer is absolutely not. You need an argument for thinking that. And it's going to vary case by case, which is why, as I said earlier, organizations need to develop an organizational capacity to deal with those kinds of things. And that's why I talk about things like ethical case law in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's exactly the right tailored kind of approach I was hoping that you would share. I mean, I mentioned this check your bias tool, and in the tool, we tell institutions to choose a set of control variables instead of just saying men and women, you know, like instead of just saying like what percent of men, what percent of women, we say like controlling for some of the things that are, that you know to be true about your customers that may fall along gender lines, like income is a predictor of creditworthiness and it's a valid one in the US, even though income falls along gender lines. So I think that's like exactly the approach that we take to.
Right. And it would be sort of, it'd be nuts in a way not to consider people's income when you're considering their ability to repay a loan.
Exactly.
So right, so you have to use income. Of course you're going to use income. Does that correlate with certain protected variables? Yes, but that doesn't mean it's ethically illegitimate. Maybe there's, you know, some argument for thinking that it still is ethically illegitimate because that, if you like, empirical fact is founded upon historical discrimination. And so we shouldn't take into account, yada, yada. But then there's real business necessities, like we do need to get a certain percentage of our loans repaid. Otherwise, we have to stop lending. So, you know, there's tough questions to ask. And one last thing I'll say is, you know, you're talking often about smaller and smaller subpopulations. Like the woman you mentioned earlier, you gave a name that at least sounded like she was from a probably historically marginalized group or something along those lines. And so it's one thing to make sure that we're not discriminating against women, but maybe you're just doing really well with white women, but you're really, you know, you do a lot of discriminating against Southeast Asian women, something along those lines. So it's going to be really important for any financial institution to identify who those stakeholders are, to figure out what are the appropriate ways of carving up these populations such that we check for bias against this set of subpopulations as opposed to that set of subpopulations, and then what fair looks like. And it might vary. It might be that 15% lending in this population is okay, but 15% lending in that population is not okay. You know, it's going to require investigation and subtlety.
Mm-hmm, totally. I'd love to end with just like a very practical question, and that would be, what advice would you give to a financial institution that's listening to this and saying, oh my gosh, we have to do something? Like, what is the first step here?
The first step is always education. I mean, a lot of people will talk about AI ethics, but they might have different understandings of what it really amounts to, right? They might think it's a tech for good thing, AI for good thing. And we want to, you know, they want to use AI to make positive social impact. Others might hear it more in the AI for not bad way, and they want to make sure that in lending, we want to make sure we don't discriminate against various subpopulations. So I think that awareness and education is really important. And then it's about getting a cross-functional team involved and creating the framework that you're ultimately going to create, that they're going to create and deploy. You're going to need people, if you're a financial institution, you're going to need your data scientists involved in some capacity, or, you know, chief data officer, chief analytics officer, someone who works under him or her. You're going to need someone from risk, someone from compliance, someone from general counsel. You need that cross-functional team because it's going to affect the entire organization. Mm-hmm. And I'll say one last thing, which is that there's a way in which I sort of think that AI ethical risk mitigation is not that difficult in principle. If you understand the issues, if you've done your research and you've done your digging, this is what I spend my time doing, then figuring out what are the problems, what are the sources of the problems, and how in principle would you solve them is not, it's not a total mystery. It's not just, you know, oh my God, this is impossible. The big problem is organizational or political will to create the kind of organizational change that's required to implement those controls, those risk mitigation strategies.
Mm. Thanks so much, Reid. And to our listeners, please check out Reid's book. You can find information on it at reidblackman.com. That's R-E-I-D, blackman.com. So thanks so much for joining us, Reid. We really appreciate you.
No, it was my pleasure. Thanks for reading my book.
Thanks. Let me just end our podcast with some closing remarks and key takeaways, things that I wrote down that I'm taking away from this conversation. Reid told us you can't math your way out of these problems, which I just love that, that kind of thinking. It's not about the numbers, it's about the people. And education, he said, was the first step. I know that's been true for me in learning about this topic. It sort of leads to practical next steps. And then, you know, you could tell from our conversation that what's really important is asking the right questions, deciding who the people are that need to be at the table asking those questions and making this like an ongoing process to address bias in an organization, or seek AI for not bad rather than having like a checklist of things to go through. As I mentioned, Women's World Banking developed a scorecard with funding from data.org to help guide institutions through this process, or rather kick off that conversation. And hopefully the scorecard is practical enough to be both an education tool and also an assessment tool that institutions can use to move forward. I think another thing that I'm taking away from this is the importance of being open and upfront about mistakes. We've learned a lot of lessons from other industries. There are mistakes expected in early stages in any new technology. So sharing missteps helps us all to do better. And it sounds like there are already conversations happening with policymakers and regulators. I think that's really critical. Women's World Banking has a network of financial services providers, for example, that are dedicated to women's financial inclusion, that are asking these questions and sharing lessons learned among one another. And then finally, finding ways of accomplishing these goals or having these conversations with existing resources, but then, as Reid said, trying to build capacity. I think that's really important. If you're a financial institution that's already making moves to accelerate women's digital financial inclusion, unbiased lending systems can increase access for financing for women entrepreneurs worldwide, and you can join the Global Women's Digital Financial Inclusion Advocacy Hub and multiply your efforts. The link is in the chat, but I'll share it here. The link is itshereconomy2.org. I love that. That's great. A huge thanks to data.org for funding Women's World Banking's work on credit bias, to Dom Magni, our podcast audio engineer, our podcast program team at Women's World Banking, Ariane Wunder and Jackie Amacher. And finally, most importantly, our guest, Reid Blackman. Please check out his book. And a huge thanks to Reid for joining us today. Thanks, everyone.